Session number 26590, General Moore, Reel 9, Mono.
The deception was very well organised.
A big one.
You were saying that the deception was very well organised.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
When you were doing those operations to push back the German airfields and attack the radar, you were saying you would go in very low. What sort of formation would you be in if you were attacking an airfield?
Then you'll usually be a fair amount of airplanes at the same time.
Yes.
So it might be two squadrons, so it might be even more, and so on. But very often it was part of, as I say, using bombers at the same time.
Mm.
So.
But if you were going in as fighters, would you be in line abreast or in two lines, or what sort of formation would you take up for the actual attack, the beating up attack?
You've got to find the you've got to find a place.
Yes.
And align yourself to it. And one point is rather important is that you've got to bring the squadron up to what you would almost call a line abreast, or you could even get to a concave sort of thing where you pull the things up so that you can get a focus on the target. But very often, of course, the targets were spread out, so people had to file around, sort of thing. You can see airplanes and so on. I had my main experience on that really on 615 Squadron at fairly early time, where we were shooting up convoys where they had the flex ships stacked in, and the bombers had to come in too. And our job was what you would call a target support, which meant that you went in just ahead of the Boston bombers. And that must be so just that it wasn't, they couldn't sort of regroup themselves again. And at that time you came very low over the sea, and you had to pull up so that you could get a survey of the target at the right distance. And then you had to get the sections that's with you up on a sort of line abreast. And in, as I say, in fact, you can even get them in front of yourself, so you can come in converging on the target. And then aim really at keeping them absolutely quiet. I mean, quelling, is that the word?
Quelling
the active defense on the ships. Of course, the problem was sometimes if the convoy was a little stretched out, somebody would have to do that and that. But the main point was really that you were right ahead of the bombers, so when they came in, they could sort of get there. Because if they came in and they had succeeded to recover, then they were just a dead loss. And so it was a very important thing. It was a pretty rough sort of thing too. And then, of course, you could see it on the camera afterwards, on the camera we have that goes with what you're shooting, that you're shooting your own airplane sort of just cross through, you know, like that. So they went far from your own shooting.
Sounds like a very dangerous business.
Yeah, a very dangerous business, but the concentration was so essential. And we did that a lot down there. That was Churchill's own squadron. But when you asked, then we also did into land, and you asked about the land. That was a little different from that, because you, of course, the navigational part was a very strong thing. And if you came with, say, two squadrons and so on, to change direction quickly is a shaky do. And it disturbs the whole sort of line of attack so much that you must try to avoid it. Mm. It takes pretty good navigation. And you fly very low, because after all, if you fly in for that sort of target, you are flying over occupied area that is highly defended, and you've got to fly so low that you are not in their shooting line. If you are flying too high, of course, that's one way of doing it, and going down. But normally on this sort of thing, we call them often rhubarb. That was when they were very few, say, two airplanes and so on. Armed reconnaissance and armed, what was the word on that? When you're attacking. If you flew in with bombers, you were mostly target support. Covering and target support, doing both of it.
If you were attacking ahead of the bombers and you were going to attack an airfield, what would you concentrate upon as your target? Would it be the air defence?
Yeah. If you were doing it alone and so on, it would be airplane on the ground.
The aircraft on the ground.
Oh, yeah.
What were the best
like the Germans did in Battle of Britain. Yeah. Yes, the best as they could.
What were the best weapons for these sort of attacks?
The 20mm formidable weapon, yes. You had four of them, by the way, you had good firepower. Mm. But you didn't have much firepower, you know, you had 11 seconds.
Yes.
And
so that is a very small number of bursts.
Yeah, and also get close before you start shooting.
Yes.
And then, of course, they start shooting before you.
Yes.
So you get all these sort of things. This was on the ships, too. You get all these sort of things coming up against you, and you hold yourself. That's a little sort of... you're getting...
Must be a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, it's a thing. They shoot, they have 40 millimeters, and that sort of thing. You see this red sort of thing coming up against you. Goodbye. So but you have to restrain yourself. You start emptying all this at distance. You probably fall short for the target anyway. After all, the bullet drops. So
What would be the best range to open fire if you were doing that sort of
thing? That sort of thing. The target is standing still. As far as you are concerned, it's practically a ship target or a ground target is standing still. So I would say 500 meters and so on. That sounds long. You wouldn't do that airplane to airplane. Mm. That would be shorter. Mm. But under that circumstances, you would open up.
But if you were 500
holding a little high and open up. But it was a shaky deal. I remember we got a newcomer in on the squadron, and he asked a friend of mine, he was a Norwegian too, incidentally, he asked him, how do you do it actually, you know, when he wasn't experienced, he was just asking and so on. And this fellow, his name was Ullis, I remember, and he said, oh, that's easy, he said, you just head on, press button D and go in for it, he said. Mm. Press button D, of course, it's the emergency frequency. So better be in advance with that one. You press button D and then you go in. So that was a pretty good advice.
If you were flying in to attack a target, how long would it take your aircraft to cover a distance of 500 yards? It would be a very short time, wouldn't it?
Yes, and it's a short time. I mean, couple of seconds. You really now it's a little longer than that, I would say, but it's longer. It was longer time if you include the time they have to shoot at you.
Of course.
Yeah.
So your own firing time must then be very short if you're opening fire at 500.
Presumably
you start overshooting fairly soon.
But I suppose it's like when you jump in a ski jump that you think it's a long sort of glide, you know, it's about a second and a half, you know, even on the longer one. So it's
you were saying earlier on how difficult it was to identify targets and identify your own troops. What about the use of recognition panels? Was that effective when you were...
What the...?
The use of recognition panels by your own troops, was that an effective way of...
Yes.
Signaling from
yes. Markers. Mm. Markers. That's a sort of mustn't come inside that. You had a forward marker. You must be beyond that.
Yes.
Yes. Was effective. Was effective. pilot became very good at that sort of thing. We called it, it was a close in Portos. Of course, you had air supremacy. So you could afford to have a cab rank system where you had people loitering around, waiting outside, behind the line, and waiting, and we put them in what we called a cab rank, and you could call out from the cab rank, call in. It's like a taxi on a waiting station in a sense, up in there. And of course, you should be so close that from the time you are being called to the time you're actually there isn't too long. You mustn't fly a long way, so you must be available. And you couldn't do that if you didn't have air supremacy. I mean, if there were German airplanes around, and so you couldn't hang in the air like that. Then you would have to have your own column for that sort of thing. So.
Do you remember when the cab rank was introduced as a system?
Well, I never experienced before we were actually on the continent. And I would even go as far as to say on the later part of the continent it became effective. I suppose somebody tried it earlier, but we did. One outfit I understand are really perfectionists, and this is the US Marine with their air division side. So they practice this very, very much. But they, of course, they take it as a precondition that the air situation is handled by other people.
It has to be favorable.
It has to be. You have to have the freedom if you're going to do a good job.
When did you actually go to Normandy yourself with the wing?
We went about a month after D-Day.
How did you get there?
We went across by ship, and we went out of we marshaled, and we these barges, you know, they took us, and we had about 300 vehicles of various kinds, and we had, as I said, pilot flew across, but the ground crew and so on, we were about 700, something like that. So it was quite a Norwegian contingent, really. And so we landed on the beach, and I remember that we should have been a little earlier, but the car on the airfield that we were designated to go to, which was B-16, which was just north of Caen, hadn't been taken. It was a little delay in that period. And so they didn't succeed as fast as they could. So we were held back too. And of course, in the beginning, we flew across the whole time, but there was more urgency for army troops and things in the first phase of the transfer. So that's why we came, you can say, that late. But it didn't, as far as the flying side, it didn't make any difference. But when I came with that lot. And we landed and we drove up to, and that harbor man, Navy, I'll never forget him. He was setting you on the right track with no doubts, you know. There was no arguing there.
Fierce man.
Yeah, and he just said, up that way, he said, stick to the rows, not to the sides, they aren't cleared yet. Oh yeah, he was, you got to experience a fellow like that.
Who actually organized the loading and transport? Did you have to do that, or was that done by some other staff?
No, we did it all ourselves. Of course, the ship's complement was shackling and all that sort of thing, but we had to do it, yes.
And how did you arrange that? Did you liaise directly with the officers of the landing ships you were going in, or did you have some other way?
No, it was just like in almost a civilian ferry thing. We drove down to the harbour and just went aboard.
A civilian ferry, not
and
a
just drove on to the thing, yes. Mm. It wasn't lifting, you could drive on deck. And of course we had these big Thornycroft trucks and a lot of other specialized vehicles, and on it we went, and off we went. Yes. And I remember when I flew over on D-Day, but that was say a month before, and my gosh, if you, I was thinking that if you bail out now, you're bound to land on a deck somewhere, you know, so there was that many ships. And, but no, we went, and we went into this B-16, and that was pretty close up to Kong, and Kong wasn't taken at that time. So they had to bring in the bombers, the big bombers, the RAF bombers and so on to do that. Apparently Arthur Harris had a lot of hesitation about diverting his bombers for other purposes, but they were taken for that, and Kong was taken.
From the time you arrived at B-16, how long did it take you to get the squadron, the wing, the squadrons in the wing operational so that they were flying?
While we were in the transfer, they operated from bases in England. Mm. And so when we were ready there, they just landed with us. So it was, there was no break at all. It was just continuous. That, of course, was the idea about this tactical Air Force setup.
Was B-16 ever attacked? Did you come under artillery or mortar bombardment or any other sort of attack?
We didn't. We didn't at that time, no. Of course, our mines weren't clad all the way. And when we came up to B-16, we got another problem, which wasn't expected. Diarrhea on personnel. This was fruit and so on that wasn't ready for use or whatever and so on. But anyway, it set on, so we had a sort of a weak period of bad tummies and so on, you know, and people running for the
Were they eating the cider apples?
Yeah, that's it.
The wrong sort of apple.
Yeah. And
did you have any arrangements for the security of the base? Because it was so close to Kong, which was still in enemy hands, it might have been.
No. But, of course we. No. Yeah, the army was around, of course, the Canadian army too, and. It's funny with one story goes where we had one truck of ours that got a little lost, got by himself, and he ran into a Canadian marshalling for a tank attack, and something happened where he got a scratch on the car or something. He took the Form D or whatever they call it, this accident form, and went up to the tank commander and wanted him to shine for the damage, you know. So it was a sort of half piece, half full, whatever you call it. I suppose it had something to do with why I was there, why I was put on that job. Having an army background and knowing my people and being in the Air Force the way I was. But anyway, this sort of looking after the crew, the ground crews and so on, and the circumstances of this nature. So I remember that this business of sort of behaving like army people, digging trenches for pits and so on. Because you've got to remember that in the Air Force, you spread out your airplanes on dispersal area, and it becomes a very individual spot. There are only two or three men around that airplane. That's the people with the weapons and or the ammunition and so on, and it's the gasoline people, and it's the rigging and the fitting, and that's about all. And they are staying out there with that airplane in a pretty lonely position. And it works on those things when you know that there are enemies all around. It's not an army unit under any sort of directly command or anything. And anyway, what they know and don't know is very vague. So they're in a pretty exposed, you can say, psychological situation.
Do they feel isolated?
Hmm?
Did they feel isolated?
Yes. Yes, they did. And especially when sort of words of threat, and knowing that the Germans were really all around, it was, the area wasn't completely taken. It was some.
It wasn't clear and secure.
Yeah, they didn't feel secure. And as I say, when you come out to this dispersal area, it's a pretty isolated place for a few people. And although they were trained with rifle and so on, you know, they feel exposed, simply exposed.
Was there anything you could do to make them feel safer?
No, except a bit more training, more so on. Learning how to dig a hole, how to behave like army fellows would do when they are so on. There's a lot to it. You've got to talk with them too in that sense. And they aren't used to it. I mean, they're used to be around the airplane on a safe place back in England. And so this is a very strange new situation to them. And it worked on them, you can say, mentally, although they weren't sort of, but they were a bit scared at times, you know, when they hear sounds or whatever it is and they wonder what it is. So.
Did any of them actually lose their nerve?
No, we had no incidents of that, no. Also, when you moved, and particularly those who became, for reasons of, say, a damaged airplane was left behind and they needed some people to attend to it, and then when they were through, they packed up and went to the truck and went off to join up with the wing. They went all by themselves. When we went, we had the police, the army, they were directing you, and they were so on, and you knew that as long as you were on safe roads. But these people, driving partly at night and so on, they could get astray, and they had to peg down or sleep in the car, and they would hear all sorts of noises around, and they wouldn't know whether they were German or Allied or whatever they were. Sometimes pretty demanding, you know. And who were they anyway? They didn't speak French, and what sort of maps did they have, you know? We never lost anyone. And there was always a sort of 6 or 7 or maybe 10 cars left behind when the B party came up, who, for reasons of doing the finishing work and so on, had to come afterwards. We never lost anyone of those, but they went through pretty scary experiences, some of them, at least in their own imagination.
Yes.
And they were, mind you, in all that area with that rapid advance, there were hidden Germans all over, who had been lost or who had sort of escaped or who were hiding or simply, they were simply there, and how they would behave, nobody could know.
These are German stragglers who are left behind.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
Now, you had a staff, didn't you, who were supporting you. So could they go round the dispersal areas, and did you have a policy of visiting the ground crew in dispersal areas every day?
Oh yes. Bound to do that. Mm. Of course, the chief technical people, they took care of their people mostly.
Yeah.
And the MT people, transport people. Of course, we had a lot of big transport fleet, as you know it was, and they took care of that and so on. So I had people doing things, but I always made it my business to move around with these people.
Could you go around every day
to
see people?
Yeah.
Make sure that they knew you were there. So.
Yeah, keep them up to date, and as far as I was up to date.
Yes.
And talk about it, and talk what they were, you know, what they felt about sort of their own security and so on. And, did that.
You were saying you keep them up to date insofar as you were. How did you keep up to date? Did you have?
Well, we had intelligence, of course.
Yes.
They were the ones who kept us abreast. So we had the daily briefings, and.
How was the daily briefing done? Was it done first thing in the morning? Was it done in the evening? And
the briefing?
Yes, the daily briefing.
Well, it had to fit in with the operation. So it's got to be when, so it was usually called at a certain time. Yeah. And so when everybody was there. Well, yeah.
Who would actually do the briefing?
Well, we had a shift of intelligent people, army people mostly, and we had Air Force, particularly for the air side and so on. We had an army liaison officer with us the whole time on the wing.
Was he Canadian Army?
No, he was this army we had, he was actually a Norwegian, but he was he had been serving in your army, and he was there. But we had a British army officer, very active one, very fine fellow, who was sort of liaison and all sorts of things. Oh yes.
So you were able to keep up to date and pass that on to the.
I never complained myself. Mm. I thought I was given what I could be given, and so on. Yes. Oh, it worked fine. Worked real fine. And I must say that cookhouse and the medical side and all that sort of thing worked fine.
Well, apart from the stomach ache due to the cider apples, what other, did you have any other medical problems or any particular?
No, not really. Mm. We had just what goes, you know. Mm. One can harm himself somewhat. And, no problem. No problem.
In effect, then, so you had no serious casualties?
No. Not except among pilots.
Yes. Well, that is to be expected. But amongst your ground crews, they were.
Mm. No.
Where were they living? Were they living under canvas when they were B-16? Yes.
We became quite known in the Second Air Force on being quite clever in organizing ourselves when we settled in, which means sort of not only the tent and the way that is, but placing the tent and the floor in the tent, because as you get into Holland and so on, you get water coming up from beneath, and the way you do that, not one particular thing that we were good at, and it paid off, especially when you move towards winter, and in the winter, making fireplaces and so on. So some of these tents, you know, knit together and so on, they could be very cozy sort of places. And they were, sometimes people came long way from headquarters just to inspect, you know, to see how we got this organized. I dare say we consumed some spill oil or something in a way. I wouldn't say that. Close your eyes sometimes on what happens, but by and large we were quite well known for being clever and organized. But I suppose it has to do with outdoor life in this country. There are people used to
knowing how to be comfortable.
Yeah, how to camp and do these things.
Where was the headquarters then? Where were you reporting to when you were in Normandy? Was that back in England, or was it out?
No, of course, second TEF provided our own headquarters, and you had 84 Group, which was our nearest command headquarters.
Where were they?
They would move along with us. So sometimes we were ahead of them, and sometimes they were just up. Of course, when you move forward in a leapfrog system, you always move up as close to the front as you possibly can come, because then you can stay that much longer. But then, of course, you get into the zone where things aren't all that ready.
Yes.
So when you think of that one, of course, you'll say, now what about the pioneer who's going to stick out there for? When do they get in? That's a big question. And sometimes you wonder yourself, on earth could they do the job in this. I had a personal experience at the very, very end of the war to do just that, to make reconnaissance for a next airfield in Germany. And I went there with the chief technical officer that we had and it was a reconnaissance south of Osnabrück or somewhere around that area, which had been identified on the map as being a suitable distance for the next airfield. But the area was virgin enemy land, and we had to drive in there with a jeep. This technical officer, Major Barkal, and I, with the equipment and maps and all the things that went on. And first of all, we had to cross bridges.